From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Election year has well and truly started, and this week saw Anthony Albanese at the National Press Club announcing funding that a Labor government would provide to help Australian children bounce back from the pandemic, as he put it. Also in the week, outgoing Australian of the Year Grace Tame created a social media storm by her snubbing of Scott Morrison at a function at the Lodge. To talk about these and other issues, our first guest for this election year is Tanya Plibersek, who is Shadow Minister for Education and for Women. Tanya Plibersek, let's start with Grace Tame, who has been the talking point of the week. Do you agree with her gesture at the Lodge?
I think Grace Tame has been a fantastic Australian of the Year. She's focused on child sexual abuse. It was absolutely right for Australia to focus on this huge issue. And I'm a bit disappointed, really, that people are focusing so much on this moment of her whole year as Australian of the Year, and that there's so much outrage about, you know, gesture with the Prime Minister, rather than focus on the actual outrage that one in three Australian women experience domestic violence, that one in five experience sexual assault, that one in four has experienced sexual harassment at work. I really wish people would reserve some of their outrage for the issues that Grace Tame and the amazing young women leaders like her, Brittany Higgins, Saxon Mullen, Chanel Contos, the issues that they're campaigning on.
You're right that she and others have absolutely elevated these issues in the past year or so. Nevertheless, we still don't seem as a society to make much progress against domestic violence in particular, to get to prevention as distinct from the much needed more assistance to victims. Why is this, and is there a way to do better?
Yes, there absolutely is not only a need to do better, but there's a way to do better. And we do know so much, Michelle, about what we can do to reduce risks of violence in interpersonal relationships. And, of course, it starts with our youngest Australians. We need to be working with kids from very early in their childhoods to teach them about respectful relationships. We can start in an age-appropriate way when children are very young to teach them about cooperation, taking turns, not bullying, not dominating, using their language, not their fists when they're sorting things out. These programs already exist, and of course we should be rolling them out in early childhood settings, in schools. We also need to rely much more on parents to model healthy relationships in the home. It disturbs me that the rates, as you say, of domestic violence don't seem to be coming down, and in fact one of the few areas of crime where statistics continue to go up are areas like sexual assault. So we need to do better at prevention. We need to do better at policing and in our justice system. I think one of the challenges has been consistency. So we've got an opportunity now with the next National Plan on Violence Against Women and Their Children to lock in another long-term approach to really tackling these issues. And we need to do practical things. Labor's proposed 10 days paid domestic violence leave. We've committed to employing 500 additional community sector workers who would work in refuges and with women and children escaping violence. But we also need to get to that root of attitudinal change that starts with young children, and it has to be long term. We didn't get smoking rates down overnight. You know, half of Australians smoked around the end of the Second World War. We've got that down to about 13% now because we've had a consistent message that smoking is bad for you. We've had laws and taxes that have reduced smoking rates, and we've seen leadership from government that has lasted beyond the electoral cycle. I think a similar approach in reducing violence long-term, backed by legislation, backed by resources for our policing and justice sectors is what's called for.
Some people might think that this is a problem that the young have become more aware of, and therefore it might sort of diminish over generations. But both anecdotally and even in terms of the evidence, that's not necessarily so, is it? You do see suggestions that there is more rather than less bullying in schools, for example, and surveys of young men, I think, have shown that their attitudes are not particularly progressive.
Yeah, it's actually, it is really sad, Michelle, because we do always think that with time, progress happens almost automatically. And the fact is that's not true. We still see some really disturbing attitudes amongst young people about the appropriateness of violence in relationships there's some pretty disturbing attitudes around forced sex. Within relationships or on dates and so on. We haven't got there yet, but I do think there's cause for hope, because we see these fantastic young women leading a national conversation about change, the change that has to happen. So, when I was growing up, the names of the victims of sexual assault we knew were women like Anita Cobby and Janine Balding, who were brutally assaulted and then murdered. The women who are speaking up today, who have experienced sexual violence and who are demanding change, give us, a whole different idea of what a survivor of violence looks like. And I think, Rosie Batty, I have to include her in this conversation, because her extraordinary bravery after she experienced the worst thing that any mother can possibly imagine, she used that terrible thing that happened to her to start the demand for change that we've seen growing over recent years. You're right about the statistics not shifting as much as we hope for, but look at those people who turned out on the lawns of Parliament House and around Australia in the March for Justice last year. Those people who would, previously have felt that quiet rage at home and not known what to do with it, turning out, demanding change from their government, saying this is an issue that will change my vote. This is an election decider for me. That is, I think it's a sign that things are changing, that our society is changing. In a way that is, I hope, unstoppable.
As you say, we've heard a lot about issues affecting women over the last year or so. Do you think there'll be an identifiable women's vote at this election? And apart from some of the policies you've mentioned, what is Labor doing to mobilise that vote?
Well, there's always an identifiable women's vote, I think. And Labor, as always, isn't just focused on the electoral politics of this. We're focused on the fundamental societal change that policies focused on equality between men and women, that the fundamental change that happens in our society, in our nation, when we pursue those policies. You look at Labor's long history of the fight for equality between men and women, and there's so many proud achievements, the Sex Discrimination Act, no-fault divorce, the first funded women's refuges, the first sexual assault services. This election, we're focused on the gender pay gap, as always. We've still got a gender pay gap, and we've got important policies changing the Fair Work Act to make sure that it is easier for predominantly female-dominated low-paid industries for there to be wage justice, wage equity cases there. We've got policies that would explicitly prohibit sexual harassment in the workplace. We're fully implementing that brilliant Respect at Work report that the Sex Discrimination Commissioner presented to the government. We are, of course, making childcare cheaper for 97% of families. We've promised 10 days paid domestic violence leave, and as I said earlier, 500 new community sector workers to help women and children escaping domestic violence. We've got a range of policies that will make a real difference to the lives of Australian women. And we're not doing it simply because Australian women are a really important section of the voting community at this election, but these are the sorts of policies that brought me and many others into the Labor Party. The reason that we joined the Labor Party decades ago is because that's where we saw the fight for equality between men and women as being best expressed.
Let's now turn to education. Schools are a state matter, but do you believe that schools need to return on time this year, and is it safe for them to do so?
Well, the day-to-day running of schools, of public schools, is a state government issue, but the Commonwealth and states have always shared funding responsibilities for schools, and I think it's important to remember that Scott Morrison likes to, you know, make pronouncements and then slide out of taking any responsibility for those pronouncements, and you see that particularly with school education. We think that there should be more national leadership on safe return to school. The Prime Minister's failure to get enough rapid antigen tests, the slow rollout of the paediatric vaccine, these are really serious problems that mean that parents are really worried about their kids returning to school. There's been a state-by-state approach to important issues like air quality in our classrooms, and that's why Labor has promised $440 million, including for capital works upgrading schools and classrooms to make return to school safer with air quality measures like air purifiers, filters, upgrading air conditioning systems, rebuilding, doing things like reinstalling windows that have been painted over so that we can open them up again, moving kids to outdoor learning where that's possible. And we've also set money aside for mental health and wellbeing initiatives for kids, because actually the last 2 years have been really hard on Australian kids. And they've been hard on everyone, but kids have missed out on so much. They've missed out on their learning, but they've also missed out on their social and emotional development. School is obviously, it's so important that kids get the basics, reading, writing, arithmetic under their belts, but it's also such an important part of their development, the friendships they make, the sports they take up, the extracurricular activities. So we've set money aside for mental health and wellbeing initiatives that would help kids get back on track as well.
So just on the going back, which is pretty immediate, are you comfortable with New South Wales schools, for example, going back imminently?
Yeah, I'm sending my kids back to school, Michelle, and I think if the medical advice is that it's safe to do so, then I'm going to back the medical advice. I have consistently said what we need to do is take the best medical and scientific advice and act on that. And we're getting plenty of advice that kids can return safely, but I know that parents and teachers would be reassured if Scott Morrison had taken more responsibility for the physical upgrades that would make air quality better in our schools, and if Scott Morrison had got enough rapid antigen tests so that the regular testing of kids and school staff could take place without the sort of worry and stress that parents are feeling at the moment. And of course, if the paediatric vaccine had been rolled out in a more timely manner. I mean, I had parents contacting me saying, they had both kids booked in for their first jab weeks ago, as soon as they possibly could. And they were getting phone calls from doctors saying that they had to cancel the vaccination because the paediatric vaccines hadn't arrived. They'd been promised but not delivered to surgeries. And these things are real disappointments, once again, from the federal government. It's frustrating for parents and for school staff who know that missing out on more school is not good for kids. They've already missed out on a lot of their learning. They've missed out on the friendships the sleepovers, the parties, the sport in the playground, kicking a ball around. They've missed out on so much over the last 2 years. They don't want kids to miss out on more, but they are really worried about the return to school for these reasons.
Now, you've canvassed the promise that Anthony Albanese made this week about helping kids bounce back of this funding. Can you explain just briefly how that funding would work? On the capital side, how would schools apply for it? Would it be administered federally or by states? On the mental health side, similarly, how would schools get it?
Well, we will be working closely with the states and territories. There is obviously a bit of a difference state by state in initiatives that have been taken so far, so we need to take that into account. But the first half of the funding, $238 million, is over two school years, 2022 and 2023. And the first part of that is $50 million for better ventilation, small scale projects as I said before, better air filtration, upgrading air conditioning systems, doors and windows that open that provide natural ventilation.
But how do you actually get it if you're a school?
Yes, we'll work with the states and territories to do that across all three sectors. So it'll be public schools, Catholic and independent schools, and it'll be on a grants basis. So we expect the average grant to be around $25,000. We calculate around 2,000 schools will benefit from that. So this is not designed to upgrade every school. This is to work in partnership with states and territories and school systems to plug the gaps, essentially. We know, for example, that in Victoria, and they've rolled out HEPA filters to every classroom. We're not going to redo what the Victorian government has already done. This will be working to fix any gaps in the system. And then the second part of that capital funding is in 2023. Again, this will be a grants process, and that'll focus actually on public schools. It'll be $188 million in 2023. That is matching public school funding with non-government school funding for that year. And it will be new and upgraded facilities decided on a grants basis. It'll be for things like new and upgraded trades training centres, so we can do better vocational education in our schools, and other facilities that will be determined by school communities. The second element of the funding package of the $440 million is a student wellbeing boost. This isn't for capital, this is for programs, and it includes $10.5 million to design a mental health check for younger children. There's a real gap with primary school aged children. We want to help schools who wish to participate. This will be a voluntary participation. Schools that want to participate, we'll work with them to design a mental health screening tool for those younger children and roll that tool out to participating schools. And the real idea is to identify any kids who need extra support and then connect them into mental health and wellbeing supports in the community. And then there's another $191 million, which is for every school. In that program, an average school would receive about $20,000 in extra funding in 2022. That's for the things like school camps, school sports, other proven wellbeing programs that will help kids essentially recover from, in some cases, months of remote learning and the disconnection from school that many have experienced.
So would that be on a needs basis in the sense of needier schools would get more? Could wealthy schools get the money as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, it'll be the needs of the school, the size of the school, and the impact of COVID and the COVID lockdowns on the school. So We'll do a more detailed formula for this in government, but it'll be size of the school, need, it'll be needs-based, and it'll be impact that the kids have experienced.
But no school would miss out.
Well, look, let's just say that the very large and very wealthy schools that have fantastic wellbeing supports already for their students won't expect the same sort of funding as a poorer school in southwestern Sydney where the kids have been in lockdown for months, or a school in Victoria where the kids have been in lockdown for months. The size of the funding will very much be affected by the need and the impact of COVID, yeah.
It's always seemed that Labor's schools policy for this election would be more modest than it was at the last election. But has the debt incurred in the course of the pandemic in fact forced Labor to rethink its school funding even further?
Well, we are still committed to reaching 100% of the fair funding level for schools at the schooling resource standard. Is the, you know, I don't want to get too technical, but you know, we had these Gonski reviews that came up with the schooling resource standard. That's the funding needed to properly teach a kid. We're still committed to getting to 100%, and this is actually a very important distinction with the government, because we are committed to getting all public schools to their fair funding level. And under the government's formula right now, their funding, the way it's operating now, the agreements they currently have with states and territories, virtually no public school will ever get to 100% of their fair funding level. And every non-government school will at least get to 100%, and most of them will go over 100%. So there's this inequality baked into the government's formula at the moment. We don't agree with that. We think that every school should get to its fair funding level, and we've made that commitment. Anthony said that in the press club speech earlier this week. That's a very important distinction, but we haven't put a dollar figure on that, because we're in the middle of funding agreements now. They will run, till 2024, so we've got some time to negotiate with the states and territories to make sure that the states and territories continue to uphold their end of the bargain. Yes, you can expect more funding from a Commonwealth Labor government, but the time frame for getting to 100% of the fair funding level for schools and the state and territory commitment as compared with the Commonwealth commitment, that's something that we will negotiate when we negotiate the next round of Commonwealth-state education agreements. But, Michelle, I mean, people can judge the difference between Labor and Liberals when it comes to school funding based on our history. It was Labor that instituted this project to actually get all schools to their fair funding level, a sector-blind, needs-based funding arrangement. The Liberals have turned their backs on that. They've cut billions of dollars from public school funding. We will always try and make sure that every child in every school system, in every part of Australia gets a world-class education.
Just turning to higher education, Labor has criticised what it described as government cuts in university funding in the forward estimates in the last budget. Would a Labor government restore the funding it says was cut?
Well, Michelle, we've already made a very substantial announcement about 20,000 extra university places. And, of course, that comes with just over $480 million, $482 million for those extra university places. It's 20,000 commencing places. That funding runs over 6 years. So that's a very substantial amount of extra funding, close to $500 million for those extra places. More than that, we do need to work with the university sector to rebuild after the impact that COVID has had on universities. We've seen about 40,000 job losses. We've seen billions of dollars lost in international student revenue. This is one of the sectors hardest hit by COVID, and it's really the only sector that the government went out of its way to deny JobKeeper payments to. So there's going to be a lot of rebuilding to do. And I think it's one of the things that is really, I think, short-sighted from this government. We know that our economy is going to need these skilled workers in the future. We've actually got one in four employers saying that they can't find the skilled staff they need. We've got around 2 million Australians who are unemployed or underemployed. We've been plugging that gap in recent years with lots of short-term migration, skilled visa holders. But we really should be training Australians for those jobs. We've got shortages of doctors, engineers, teachers, pharmacists, IT specialists, like so many jobs that you need a university education for. And we've got record numbers of Australian students being turned away from university, actually record turnaway rates just last year. It just makes no sense to have skills gaps, employers screaming out for skilled staff, young people who want to go to university, they want to work hard, they're prepared to take on the HECS debt that goes with a university education, and this government not making enough places available. So we do need to make those places available. We need to rebuild the university research capacity. I mean, the absolutely shocking, last minute Christmas Eve announcement of research funding grants this year, the government's, very deliberate culture wars, cancelling of half a dozen grants because they didn't like the topics of the grants. I mean, this is no way to run a university sector in Australia. That's why, as well as the extra places, Labor's committed to a universities accord where we'd work with universities, with employers, with others that have an interest in having a strong university sector to try and get a bipartisan agreement on what we expect of our universities. Do we expect them just to operate as businesses? Do we expect them to fill a public good, a public need in Australia? These are fundamental questions that would be so much easier if we could actually agree across the aisle on what we want from our universities and then have some long-term policies so that there is certainty in the sector, so students get a great education, so our brilliant researchers get some certainty about their work, their future, so they're not scrambling for grants at the last minute or, you know, we're still leaving research altogether, travelling overseas, staying overseas because they can't get their research funded in Australia. We need to have some predictability and some certainty for universities.
Just finally, Labor was very critical of the government's rearranging of student fees that now has students in arts and some other courses paying huge fees compared with previously and certainly compared with students in other courses. Would a Labor government let that system stand or would you overhaul it quickly?
Well, again, this is the sort of thing that we need to work through in the university's accord. But I can tell you, it's just so thick-headed from the government to use these students' fees as just, you know, one more weapon in their culture war. You're talking about fees of around $60,000 for a four-year arts degree. I can't see that as sustainable in the future.
So why would there be hesitation about changing it?
Well, we can't do everything all at once. We've got 20,000 extra places. We've got a commitment to a fundamental overhaul of our university sector through the Accord. I want to make sure that every young Australian who is prepared to work hard and study hard can get a place at university and that no one's discouraged because of the fees.
So would you be aiming to change at some stage, but you wouldn't put a time frame on it? Is that your position?
I'm always going to aim to make university education more affordable for Australian students. I don't want to see these hardworking, great young Australians discouraged from going to university. And look at our record, Michelle. Because of the uncapping of student places when Labor was last in government, an additional 200,000 students got a chance to go to university. So many of them were the first in their family to go to university. We saw really substantial increases in kids from the bush, from regional communities and rural communities going to university, big increases in Indigenous students, big increases in students with a disability or English as a second language. We really targeted our efforts at those underrepresented groups, and that would be my aim and my commitment should I become the Education Minister.
Tanya Plibersek, thank you very much for talking with us today. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast, but we'll be back with another interview soon. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.